listening to Ouija Broads. This is Liz.
And this is Devin.
Devin, first off, you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to thank patrons because I like putting it at the beginning.
Yes.
We had somebody who became a patron like while we were taping the last episode. I felt so bad. I got off the computer and I was like, oh, whoops. We just did that.
So marvelous.
Damien, thank you. You missed it by a minute and now you're in this one.
Oh, good job, Damien. Thank you.
And Jody, thank you. And Johnny. And Nathan. It was a bumper crop.
Damn, folks, we love you. Yeah. You guys are just getting excited for Christmas, and you're waiting to see what we send you out as the Christmas gift.
Well, I told you, too, I want to do something for the people who have been patrons for a year or more. And
yes.
I don't know, it might just be a thank you note or something. Even though mail is very challenging. Mail really just brings out my executive dysfunction or whatever it is.
Oh.
I'm like, too hard. Too hard.
On it about mail. Having lived in Boston means I am really good at sending out letters and postcards, I feel.
Oh, okay. You mean because you lived someplace else? I got stuck on, like, Boston. Is Boston known for that?
We're really known for writing letters.
You know what they say about people from Boston?
Mm-hmm. They're assholes. Fucking true. No, I just feel like I got a really good start writing letters. Erin and I wrote them when she moved away at age 13 to Nevada. And so I had like that tradition of having a really long pen pal because we wrote until she moved back to Spokane at 19. And I just really enjoy getting letters. So I think I'm good at remembering to send them to other people too. So yes, we'll take care of it. The people who have been around for more than a year, we got you covered. The people who are still with us come Christmas, we got you covered.
Thank you, Johnny, Nathan, Jody, and Damien.
Thank you.
Thank you, new patrons. We just actually recorded half an hour that was supposed to be about the jobs that we've had and turned out to just be a whole discussion about tattoos that we have. So
mm-hmm.
That's going up for the patrons when I get to it. I'm going to jump right in because I have bitten off quite a bit, not more than I can chew, but a big one.
A big one.
A heavy hitter.
This was supposed to be, if you recall, Miss Wood, you were being restricted.
Dr. Wood.
Dr.
Listen, if we're going to be buttheads, I'm going to be a butthead.
What do you mean, if? You are always a butthead. You are Captain Butthead, President of the Buttheads.
So you were going to say that I promised I was going to do a story that only needed one source for research.
Yeah.
And I did not entirely hew to that, but that's not why I'm nervous. I'm nervous because this is like Calamity Jane level famous, right?
Ugh.
So it's not like when we say things where it's like, oh, you know, George Gore. Like, who cares if I mess up a fact about George Gore?
Totally.
Like, fine, whatever. And then there's other things that people are a little more invested in. But this one is like, historians have opinions and there's active scholarship. And I'm like, oh, no. It's a real thing, but I want to do right by it.
Okay.
So here we go. And I contain myself to not very many resources.
Okay.
Not very many. But they were fun. So I wanted to tell you about the two deaths of Sacagawea.
Oh! Oh, marvelous! I'm so interested in this one.
Where we will begin is the Louisiana Purchase. We can go all the way back to April 30th, 1803, and President Thomas Jefferson's minister to France signs a document that is, at least according to this resource, and I followed the logic, pretty much as important as the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution. We paid $15 million for the Louisiana territory.
Really? I didn't think it was that much. $15 million?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money, dude.
It is, but for over half a billion acres of land and doubling the size of your entire little country, that's
pretty
good. We got
a steal.
Yeah, like, this is, you know, I mean, it's Thomas Jefferson doing this, right? Like, the ink was still wet on everything, and he's like, more. Let's get all this. So, the Louisiana Purchase is everything from the Mississippi to the Rocky Mountains, as far north as Montana, including Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, most of Wyoming and Montana, and portions of Minnesota, North Dakota, New Mexico, and Colorado.
That's for 15 million. It's like a million a state.
Yeah, right?
It's like a buck an acre.
Not bad at all. So Jefferson was very into this. He was a naturalist in his way. He was curious. He was one of those, you know, prototypical polymaths, which, you can do a lot of thinking and a lot of speculating about self-reliance when you have hundreds of slaves to do everything for you.
Yeah.
But he wanted to explore these lands. And as we've discussed on the show before, he had opinions about what we would discover in those lands, including he was kind of hoping for mastodons.
Yes.
Because he was in that argument with the French guy, I think it was Cuvier or something, about which country was better. And that we were better because we had, you know, big beasts and here are the bones of them. The guy was like, well, obviously they died, so your country can't be that great. And so Jefferson mailed him a dead moose. And that was that, I guess. But he was hoping for mastodons.
I, too, end a lot of arguments by mailing roadkill to my enemies.
Right?
It is effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really gets your point across. It communicates so many things. It's like flower language.
Yeah, it is articulate in a way that surpasses words.
Yeah, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, a dead moose is worth easily 10,000 because it's 3D. Oh,
3D.
And bigger than any 10 pictures.
Oh, absolutely.
So Jefferson is very excited about all this land for various reasons. One is that he would like to be able to have the country go from ocean to ocean, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's what he wants to do.
Sea to shining sea, man.
Yeah, he wants to establish the commerce lines all the way across. He's kind of hoping there might be a very convenient river that just kind of goes down the middle of it in a highway style way. And he's like, we got to get in there. We got to see what we bought.
Okay.
Which is fair. We have to go look at it. He kind of like fire sailed it, right? He like bought it at auction and then was like, okay, let's go see what we actually came up with.
It's like when you bid on a storage unit. And you're like, yes, okay.
Exactly. This is Storage Wars 1803.
Yes.
Yeah, except there's already people there.
Yeah, it already belongs
definitely
to other people.
Somebody's stuff.
Yeah.
And that underlies all of this and makes it a little hard to be as jovial about as we might, but
yeah,
it is what it is. So Jefferson wants to get in there, and he has this neighbor, Meriwether Lewis, who also had an interesting life and death, which we may cover at some point. Meriwether's 29. He had served in the Whiskey Rebellion. He'd served in some Ohio wars, and he's like, oh, I know who I need to take with me, William Clark. Who's burly, redheaded, 6 foot tall. He's a veteran artillery officer. And they go, yes, we are going to do this thing. We are going to go on this core of discovery. We're going to go into the unknown. So they leave from St. Louis. They go up the Missouri River, or the Missouris, or the Missouri, or Missouri. You guys have to get on Facebook.
You have to.
And see the joy that I've been having with William Clark's journals, because there is bad spelling. And that's normal, right? Like, we all misspell things, especially back in the day. Like, there's no spell check.
Yeah.
He's just doing his best. But this guy seriously spells Sue 20 different ways. Not an exaggeration. And so I just took some of his very fine spellings of things and tried to put them all in one place, just so you can appreciate all his different spellings that, I mean, you get a very good sense of how he pronounces stuff.
You do. It's Yeah,
Musquitters.
Musquitters.
He's from Kentucky.
It's an accent you can see.
Mm-hmm. And pretty much taste it. It's crunchy.
It is crunchy. Yep. It's like if you mute Natalie Dormer speaking, you can see the accent still.
Yeah. Yeah. So Clark is, I don't know. He really has grown on me through the process of reading the journals, and I'll talk more about that later. But they head out. They go up the river, right? They're waiting because the purchase isn't even finalized yet.
Yeah.
So basically, they just wait. And they're recruiting people, they're getting through the winter, they're chilling out, they're wintering along the upper Missouri near the Knife River in a stockade in Fort Mandan. They are working on making some tentative maps. They are meeting with delegations of the different tribes in the area. They are chatting with folks. They're figuring out who's good to take and what their supply options are. There's two figures that we will note that are with them at this point. One is Seaman.
Yes.
Who you've done an episode about. Yes. And the other is York, who I feel like we should also do an episode about. York was enslaved by Clark. So York was what the tribes in the area would call a black white man. So they were like, he's not light skinned, but he's a white man. So they're white men and black white men.
Huh.
So he was a slave. And I have not had the time to read into what we know about him or why he was the only one who came along or what the deal was.
Huh.
But he was along on this journey.
Dude, I didn't even know there was a black man on the Meriwether Lewis, sorry, the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Yeah, Lewis and Clark were both slaveholders.
Hmm.
Just putting that out there.
All right.
but I will argue that York was not the only slave on the journey after a point, but we'll get to that. So they're in Mandan territory. There's Hidatsas. There's Arikaras.
Yeah.
And one important note gets dropped at this point. There's a Minotauri guy who says, the Shoshone have a lot of horses, and they might trade them to you. And then you could use them to get through the mountain passes. And he's like, oh, okay, interesting. And on November 3rd, Clark writes down, a Mr. Shoshone, interpreter for the Gros Ventre Nation, came to see us. So, Shoshone.
Shoshone.
Shoshone. Charbonneau.
Yeah.
Shoshone. Shimona. She, but he just, you gotta, it's just, let me go through the justice to just some of the ones that I found. Like,
yes.
Nobody collated these for me. This was just me flipping through and going, oh, no. Oh, no.
And you guys, before Liz even did this beautiful album of memes she made on misspellings, I was getting these as text after text after text.
I had to tell somebody.
It's marvelous.
It was wild. I was experiencing it in real time. I was in Missouri in 1804 reading about people dying of dysentery.
Dysentery!
And the musquetters. And a very warm wing.
Warm wing! A warm wing overtook them.
Charbonneau gets Chabona, Charbonneau, Shoshone, Shoshone with an S, Shabonar, Chabona. Let's see. We kind of had that one. Shoshone, Shabounds, my favorite. Shabano, Charbonneau, and then finally our interpreter. He's our interpreter.
Interpreter. I'm glad he was there to interpret for them.
Yes. He is a 46-year-old French-Canadian trapper named Toussaint Charbonneau. And he lives among the Minotauris. He is a disaster. Like, everything, I cannot say enough bad stuff about this guy.
He's gross.
He's gross. But what he brings to the table is initially two, I'm going to say wives, because that's normally how it's presented. These were two young women who had been abducted from their home tribes and sold or gambled to Charbonneau. And he was keeping enslaved, right?
Yeah.
Like, they were sex trafficked to him. Sorry to be whiplashing with the tone here, but I think wife is a really anodyne, minimizing thing to describe what was going on with Sacagawea. Like, no, a wife is somebody who has entered into a marriage contract.
Uh-huh.
She was a slave.
Yeah.
She did not have any place else she could go. She was a teenager.
Yep.
She was about 15. She had been captured when she was 11.
Yep.
Yeah. And she was, so she's 15. She's with this French-Canadian guy who's 46.
Uh-huh.
And she's pregnant.
Yeah.
She's pregnant. And she's kind of into the expedition, though, because she wants to try to get back home. And they're like, oh, okay, you're from the Shoshone. You can talk to the Shoshone for us. Charbonneau also has another Indian quote-unquote wife, Otter Woman, and he has a son by her who's also named Toussaint, but she doesn't come along.
Okay.
But it's going to confuse the issue later, so I bring it up. Let's back up a bit and talk about Sacagawea.
Yes.
Or Sacagawea or Sacagawea or
yes.
Bird Woman or Snake Woman. So one of the things that we don't really know is her name, right?
Yeah.
We do at least have that Clark tried to spell it a lot of times, mm-hmm. and it seems to have been that he would say it with a hard G, right? So Sacagawea, not Ja.
Yeah.
He seemed to have thought that it was Sacagawea, although to be honest, he mostly called her the squaw, which was his attempt at a word for Indian women, which we don't use anymore. But it was not derogatory explicitly from him.
You use it if you sing the songs from Disney's Peter Pan.
Yep. And that's why we don't. So we don't know in part technically which tribe she belonged to, because the spelling and the meaning of her name would vary accordingly.
Okay.
So if she was from the Hidatsa, then it would be more like Sikakawias.
Okay.
Versus if she was strictly Shoshone, then it would be more with the hard G, and it would mean more like boat launcher, versus in Hidatsa, it would be bird woman.
Huh.
And we don't know. So the Lemmy Shoshone call her Sacagawea.
Okay.
And most people spell it Sacagawea, but pronounce it with a J. So
yeah.
I'm probably going to try to say Sacagawea and probably slip into Sacagawea just because that's what I learned. But I don't know, and honestly, nobody really knows at this point.
Yeah.
Her role in the expedition, I think, because it makes a better painting, people mm-hmm. often portray her as being a navigator.
Yeah.
Which is not a role she normally took on. Not least because, like, nobody really was that good at navigating this tremendous parcel of land. Like, why most people aren't exploring? Like, we wouldn't set out from Spokane and be like, I'm going to on foot explore Montana.
No.
Like, no, that, like, just go, if you need to go to Montana for a reason to talk to the people who are in Montana, you can do that. That's different.
It's totally different. Yeah.
Nobody else is seeing this as virgin land. They're like, we fucking live here.
Yeah, exactly. That's fine.
Yeah, their land is not empty. More often, she was an interpreter, because she was good with languages. She's very good at procuring food, which was, of course, incredibly important. And mm-hmm. what comes up again and again in the journals is the diets are bad. Either they're bad because they're very limited, and people are like, if I have to eat one more dried fish, I swear to God. Or the meat is going bad, or they're not getting enough vitamins.
Yeah.
So having somebody who can say, hey, these berries are safe to eat.
Yeah.
Or, hey, did you know if you peel off the outer layer of this, you can eat the inside of this grass or whatever is tremendously important.
You can't overstate the value of that.
Yeah. And because she's had this baby, she's also a reassurance that they're not a war band. Because, again, the land is not empty. They're moving through different territories. And they are, in their way, trying to communicate that they're like, the United States owns this now.
Yeah.
And what? It's like 1803, 1804. The United States is like younger than you and I are.
Totally.
So they're like, sure, guys. Sure.
Yeah.
They're like, whatever. All right. Okay. You brought us a cool medal with Thomas Jefferson's face on it mm-hmm. and some tobacco. So that's nice.
Yeah, that was kind of
you. Good luck with your country. Enjoy. But as they're traveling, one of the things that communicates to them, besides Seaman, who is so friendly and interesting, and I do like getting to see him show up in the journals too, is the fact that there's this teenage girl walking along with a baby on her back.
Yeah.
They're like, okay, we don't know what you're doing, but it can't be attacking us because she's right there.
Right.
And that was one of the first interactions, actually. One of the first times that Clark ever writes about her is when this little baby is born.
Aww.
And she has a hard labor.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's young and all labor was especially scary and bad in those days. February 11th, 1805, she produces Jean-Baptiste, or as they call him, Little Pomp. And she's having a very hard labor, and another one of the interpreters says, oh, what you have to do is give her crushed rattlesnake rattles. And okay. that works every time. And Lewis is very concerned for her because he seems to have had a pretty tender heart for her.
Yeah.
He says, oh, okay. And he has got a specimen that he's been collecting because they were collecting stuff the whole way, yeah. right? Like they're trying to do some kind of proto-naturalism. Yeah. They sent him back. They sent Jefferson a prairie dog at one point, which maybe I'll tell you about.
Good Lord.
It ended up with Barnum, of all things.
Of course.
But, yeah. but... He's like, I have a rattlesnake rattle. So he sacrifices his rattlesnake Aww. Specimen so that she can have it. And he's like, she produced the baby pretty soon afterward, but I'm not really sure that's what helped, but I don't know.
oh, honey, he tried.
He tried. It was a nice gesture. So
good job, Lewis.
They said that Pompeii or Pomp was a Shoshone word that meant firstborn. I don't know.
Who, yeah.
But I do know everybody loved him. Like, I was on a conference call yesterday that went the same way because somebody was working from home and they were like, oh yeah, I'm home because my baby's sick. And as soon as everybody saw the baby, it was just, ah,
yep.
Baby!
Yep.
And of all things, these fur trappers and, you know, fighters and everything, they're like, oh, the baby!
The baby! I know. It would just yeah. give you something common to rally around, I think. Mm-hmm. And it would, in a very, to them, scary and untamed, you know, wilderness place, I think, provide a reminder of something domestic and gentle and innocent. Right? And it would give you a real, like, oh, we're doing this for them. Him.
Yeah.
No, generations. Like, nobody's- yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say nobody's raising families. The people that they're interacting with are not families, right? They're not settling down. They're interacting with essentially leaders
yeah.
and ambassadors and yeah. sometimes soldiers and warriors. They're not hanging out with families.
Yeah.
But oh my gosh, they would bounce him on their knees. They would sing with him. They would dance with him. Spoiled rotten all the way to the Pacific and back.
Good.
Youngest guy ever to make that trip.
Right? Do you know anything about where Jean-Baptiste was born? Was she in the company of other women? What, you said another translator said they need a rattlesnake, but was it a female translator? I thought she was the only woman reliably around. So did she labor without a doctor or anything, as far as we know?
I mean, definitely without a doctor. So yeah. this is still when they're at Fort Mandan. So there okay. may have been a woman or two around.
Okay.
I think Otter Woman is probably still around okay. at this point. But no, the interpreter is a guy, another French-Canadian guy. And I don't know, because what we're so limited by is, you know, she was an American, but she was not a citizen of the United States, yeah. right? And even if she were, there's no Social Security Administration, there's no right. birth certificates, she's not traveling through and living in a place where there's a lot of legal records. So right. almost everything that we know about her is through their journals.
Wow.
And for some reason, and I think honestly it's because they didn't think of this as a huge deal.
Yeah.
They were not writing down stuff in great detail sometimes.
Yeah.
They'll just start talking about people and you're like, who are these guys? Like, you haven't introduced them at all. they're writing like they're the only ones who are going to read this stuff.
Yeah. Because they apparently must have thought they were.
Yeah. So like the only thing we know about the delivery is how it affected Clark. That he was, you know, just making notes to himself, thinking about whether rattlesnake rattles actually help.
Right. Dinner was late today.
That's all we know. Yeah. That's all that's on his radar. But they take off.
Okay.
They head out. They become close. And the trajectories of Clark's regard for Charbonneau and Sacagawea are in completely opposite directions. So as she's going along, she's like, oh, look, wild artichokes. Here's some berries. Here's some goose eggs. Here's what's going on with these guys. I'm going to translate. I'm going to help you out.
Yeah.
Or like on May 14th, famously, one of the boats that her husband is steering tips over. Now, she manages to catch basically everything that's been washed overboard.
Oh my God.
Meanwhile, Lewis is like, Charbonneau is the worst steersman in the party, the most timid waterman in the world. Like, so pissed at him, but very impressed with her possession, like her self-possession. She's got a fucking baby on her back.
And she's got a baby,
right.
And so
she's like, all right, I'm going to grab your journals. I'm going to grab your artificial horizon and your sextant so that you can yeah. keep making weird measurements.
Yeah.
Apparently this is important to you.
Oh my goodness.
And he becomes very focused on her, not in like a creepy way, as far as I know, but in a, you know, he realizes Charbonneau is not looking out for her well-being. And right. Charbonneau was an abusive guy. Like, we knew he wasn't a good guy, but at least at one point over dinner, he actually backhands her.
Yeah.
And Lewis actually brings him up on a charge and says, you don't do that again, which is pretty unusual, I think, yeah. for that era. At that time, he's like, you can't hit Janie, which is what he gave up and started calling her.
Oh, okay. And this is Lewis, not Clark.
Did I say Lewis?
You just said Lewis. You've said Lewis a couple times, so now I'm confused, but I think you mean Clark.
I think I do mean Clark. So, yeah, Clark was affectionate toward her, very careful of her. They both liked her quite a bit. So Lewis is the one who said Charbonneau is the worst steersman in the party. He's the most timid waterman in the world. But both of them are basically going, okay, Charbonneau is self-centered, yeah. violent, inattentive, lazy, and she is the opposite of all these things.
They love yeah. their buddy.
They are very concerned for her well-being. Like, she gets sick and they try to get her medicine. There's another part where everybody gets caught out in the rain and Lewis is fretting up, or no, sorry, Clark is fretting about her because he knows that she's like recovering from being sick. Of all the people that they could talk about, you can tell there's a warmth yeah. there. And we don't know how she felt about it.
Right? Totally.
She didn't write journals. But as they're traveling along, they are going around the Great Falls. They're nearing the headwaters of the Missouri. And Sacagawea finds the exact spot where 5 years earlier she'd been taken captive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Lewis, I think, misses the mark here because he says she does not show any distress at these recollections or any joy at the prospect of being restored to her country, for she seems to possess the folly or the philosophy of not suffering her feelings to extend beyond the anxiety of having plenty to eat and a few trinkets to wear. And it's like, okay, Lewis, what you don't know
yeah.
about what she's feeling
yeah.
could fill all the books that have been made so far.
Yeah, exactly. A couple like, more journals on that, my friend.
Yeah, like, you don't know how she feels about this, because she's not telling you about it, because right. she's not crying and tearing her hair out.
Right.
She has been through hell and back. She got stolen when she was 11.
Yeah.
11, she gets kidnapped and sold into sex slavery.
Yeah.
By the time she's 15, and I don't know what happened between point A and point B, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't Disneyland.
Probably not. So, yeah.
Why is she going to just wear all her feelings on her face about this?
I feel like to survive at some point, you cry all your tears about that and you lock that mm-hmm. away like a hard little diamond somewhere deep in your mind and you don't show it to the seemingly kind but basically unknown white dudes who are like, hey, let me use all of your knowledge for free, okay?
Mm-hmm. You're like, you know, it's very nice that you're looking after me, but I literally don't have a choice whether or not to be here.
Yep.
Which doesn't perturb you because you have York right here who also doesn't have a choice whether or not to be here.
Yep.
Yeah, this was not a, like, collection of people who decided to explore. It's some guys who wanted to explore and the people they brought along.
And, yep. The folks along for the ride.
Yeah. And, like, I don't know about her, obviously. I don't know her life, but I can't imagine that she was that she was completely indifferent to it. I think either she was numb because it was traumatic, or she was just simply not expressing it in a way he understood.
Totally.
So, they push on. They cross the Continental Divide. They get into present-day Idaho. And in August 1805, actually encounter the Shoshone. So, they're there. They're in her territory, right? And they're split up. This was a thing they did a lot. So we call it the Lewis and Clark Expedition, but a lot of times they would split up and one of them would go ahead with some guys or would double back to get supplies or drop off things they wanted to send back.
Oh, okay.
So often that's part of why they each have their own journal, is they were separated.
Okay. For
a not insignificant chunk of the time. So things start off a little odd with the Shoshone with Lewis, where the elders are kind of like, I don't know what your deal is, but again, you did bring tobacco. I'm not really sure. Okay, sure. You can chill. We're going to paint your face for you. We're going to hug you. Lewis says, I was heartily tired of the national hug. Apparently they were Much too much of huggers for them.
those are people after my own heart.
Yep. And they're having odd discussions with the chief, who's Chief Kameawait. And he says, you know, I heard that you were going to come set us up into an ambush. And he's like, no. But there's tension. Fortunately, not long after, Sacagawea and Clark show up. She sees her village for the first time in 5 years. Mm. She dances. She's so happy she dances. And she signs, apparently, "This is my tribe." And there's another core member. So Lewis and Clark weren't the only ones keeping journals. There were other people who were writing it down. And Patrick Gass says that the other Shoshone who saw her were transported with joy. So they bring her in. You know, they all come in. They're meeting up with Lewis.
Yeah.
And she is sent in to interpret. And when she sees Chief Kameawait, she runs to him and embraces him weeping because that's her brother.
Oh, my God.
And they're finally back together.
How fucking cool, dude. I'm gonna cry.
Mm-hmm. It makes me happy.
That's incredible.
Yeah, he probably thought she was dead.
Yeah.
And she probably thought she was never gonna see him again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she facilitates this conversation where they're like, you know, we're not gonna fight you, but you know, America's in charge of you now. And he's like, sure.
You in what army? You don't have one yet.
Pretty much, right? Like, he's like, okay, she says, I'm going to keep going with them. And again, we don't know what the context of that discussion was. Like, did she feel like she had the option to stay? Would he have backed her play if she was like, I'm not going to hang out with Charbonneau anymore. I don't want to be anywhere near him. Kill all these white motherfuckers. Right. Like, I don't know.
Right?
I don't know if that was an option on the table for her. Or not. I don't know how close they were or what the politics were, but he's like, okay, you're going to stay with them. You've got your husband. You got your baby. You guys are going to hang out. All right, carry on.
Okay.
Do your thing. So there's a couple other incidents. Again, like, they write about her when it impacts them.
Uh-huh.
There's one incident, let's see, that I want to bring up just to express how it's confusing to try to understand what's going on when there's almost, they only write about their own feelings, right?
Yeah.
So they'll say, like, I'm very indisposed, or I don't feel good, or I guess anger comes through because sometimes people fight.
Okay.
But here's an incident that happened in late 1805. One of the Indians had on a robe made of 2 sea otter skins. The fur of them were more beautiful, or as Clark puts it,
butterful,
than any fur I had ever seen. Both Captain Lewis and myself endeavored to purchase the robe with different articles at length. We procured it for a belt of blue beads, which the wife of our interpreter, Shoshone, wore around her waist. And I've read that and read that and read that and tried to look into it, and that's, like, that's all we know. And I'm like, was she helping?
Yeah.
Or were they stealing from her?
Yeah.
You know, did she say, they wanted to give that robe to President Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
This is one of the things they wanted to send back. So it was important. It wasn't just like, oh, that's pretty. But why would she be willing to do that? Did she have a choice?
Right.
There's just like a little shadow against the wall that flickers, and that's all you get to understand what's happening here. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely.
But intriguing.
Yeah.
Yes, and then they arrive at the Great Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And they make camp. They're like, okay, we're here. We're going to winter over here. We can do it. Let me find the part about the Great Ocean because it made me very happy. Clark, again, like, for a dude who has all the things wrong with him that people of that era did, it's hard not to get a little bit in his head and feel affectionate toward him because he wears his heart on his sleeve in the journal so much.
Does he?
Yeah. So here's his entry for when they get, they're at the ocean, right? They've made it to the Pacific. They've made it from Missouri to the Pacific. So let's see. He's talking about a disagreeable situation, men all employed in mending their leather clothes, socks, etc. This is the thing he did. He definitely yada yada'd. He'll just write, and see, and see. And he'll be like, you know, we ate elk and sea and sea. And I'm like, what?
And what? And ferns what else and mushrooms?
Et cetera, what?
And a bear jumped yes. out? What's going on here, yeah. bro?
And dressing some lather, the sea, which is immediately in front, roars like a repeated rolling thunder, and have roared in that way ever since our arrival in its borders, which is now 24 days since we arrived in sight of the Great Western Ocean, O-C-I-A-N. I can't say Pacific, as since I have seen it, it has been the reverse. And then for some reason, this entry ends with elegant canoes. So I don't know if he was doing a captcha or captcha. Yeah, I can't yeah. say it.
Captcha.
But it's just like elegant canoes.
Wait, can you say...
What about elegant canoes, man?
What about them? It was just a note for later. Yeah. He was going to look it up on yeah. Google when he got back to reception.
That's another thing, and that's why I want to get my hands on, like, actual copies, is he was apparently a doodler, and he liked to make little weird notes on stuff.
Marvelous. So sometimes
we just do have things where it's like, okay, obviously he wrote this much later, but we don't know why or what he was thinking about.
Right.
And so it's hard to articulate exactly why they have two journals, or two entries for the same day. Sometimes I won't get into it, but he says also, the immense, E-M-E-N-C-E,
yeah.
the immense seas and waves which break on the rocks and coast to the southwest and northwest roars like an immense fall at a distance, and this roaring has continued ever since our arrival in the neighborhood of the seacoast, which has been 24 days since we arrived in sight of the Great Western, for I cannot say Pacific Ocean, as I have not seen one Pacific day since my arrival in its vicinity. That joke was so good, he put it in both entries.
I see that. And Liz, what... For those of you following along at home who might need explaining what the double entendre is, I could explain it for you, but I like it better when Liz explains it. What the fuck joke is he making? I don't get it.
Oh, Pacific as in peaceful.
Oh,
right, as
oh,
in, like, pacified or whatever.
Oh,
he's saying,
oh.
There's nothing peaceful about this ocean.
Oh.
Its waters are forming and petually, which our guess is perpetually.
Yeah.
The waters are forming and petually break with immense waves on the sands and rocky coasts, tempestuous and horrible.
Yeah, that's not Pacific at all.
He's so mad at the ocean.
He's so mad at the ocean.
This part is a little intriguing. When they get to the ocean, all the members of the expedition vote where they're going to put their winter fort, including Sacagawea and York.
Huh.
So I don't know if there was some kind of, like, forgive the pun, but, like, esprit de corps that's happening where they're like,
yeah.
we're all in this together, we can't maintain class boundaries, or
yeah.
what? Again, just this big mystery of your... It's so frustrating to try to work backward from the behavior of people that you're like, you weren't that far back.
Yeah.
You're not so far... You're not, like, Greeks...
Yeah.
In the ancient times,
yeah.
that I just have to kind of infer why you're
yeah.
trying to feed somebody to eels or whatever. this should be comprehensible.
Totally.
Oh, so they make camp. They're gonna spend the winter there. They see a beached whale, a dead whale at one point,
hey.
Which, as we know, happens. Oh, I should call out specifically where they are. So they're basically... They make this thing called Fort Clapsa. Let me try again.
Yep.
Fort Clatsop, which is about 5 miles southwest of where Astoria is mm-hmm. now.
We now have Clatsop County.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where they are. So, of course, the whales washing up on the beach, they don't have dynamite.
Thank God.
One thing that I do like is that she insists that she gets to go see it. She, like, puts her foot down. She's like, look, I came all the way out here.
Yeah.
We've gone 4,000 miles.
Yeah.
I want to see the big dead fish.
I don't blame her. She's never seen an ocean before, let alone an animal that is that large. Who has, unless yeah. they've been on an ocean? Good mm-hmm. for her. Sacagawea, you do you, baby girl. You go see all the dead yeah. whales you want, honey.
Exactly. You earned it and then some.
Yeah. Take your little yeah. baby. You, both of you, go see this big old Leviathan.
No, you ditch the baby on somebody. Somebody else watches.
Someone else will take care of the baby. It's fine.
You're like, here, play with this gigantic knife and I'm going to have whiskey.
So, that sounds Christmas like my upbringing.
Oh, God. Christmas 1805. This is what Clark writes. I received a present of, again, I don't know what the hell this says, fleece hosiery, vest draws, and socks of Captain Lewis. So apparently Lewis gave him some clothes.
Yeah.
That's the best I can do.
Yeah, a fleece hosiery.
White House gives him a pair of moccasins.
Guterich
gives him a small...
They're shoes that ridicule you.
Yes. They just sass you.
They just sass you the whole time.
Moccasins.
Moccasins.
Guterich gives him a small Indian basket, and Sacagawea, or the wife of Shibono, as he puts it, gives him 24 weasel tails and some black roots. And then he just finishes up with, GD saw a snake passing across the parth. Okay. What'd you give her, dude?
Yeah, what'd you give her?
She gave you 24 weasel tails? Yeah. That's, I think, really nice.
Yeah, that sounds
I think it's
good.
Really nice that she gave you a Christmas present. Mm-hmm. Her Christmas present is you don't have scurvy. Yeah.
It's nice that she celebrated a holiday you celebrate and she doesn't. Wasn't that kind of mm-hmm. her? Maybe you should be giving her something back.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I bet Charbonneau didn't give her anything. Charbonneau. See, he's got me doing it now.
My
I bet
Sharona.
He didn't give her anything.
Yeah.
He certainly.
Yeah.
Shimon. Didn't give Clark anything.
Totally
but apparently,
no.
She at least felt like giving him 24 weasel tails was a good move for, again, ambiguous, never to be known reasons. So they've made it to the Pacific. And then you got to go all the way back.
You do. You've done 2,000 miles. Now it's time to do the reverse 2,000.
And as they part ways, they actually, as I recall correctly, ditch Charbonneau for a while, or like he ditches them.
Okay.
Like there's a lot of discipline issues, as we saw in some of the macros I made, such as the person who was in an up mistake.
In it, yes.
He was in and a mistake, you know.
Yeah, you know.
Or the person who Dodo Don Bad.
I love that. Dodo Don Bad.
They Dodo Don Bad.
They Dodo Don Bad.
Or the guy who lost his tomahawk. It happens. Happens, man. So, but in the end, he pays Charbonneau. Of course, Sacagawea doesn't get any payment because she can't really own property. She is property.
Oh, God.
So, this perturbs Clark, though. So what he ends up writing to Charbonneau is, you have been with me a long time and conducted yourself in such a manner as to gain my friendship. Your woman, who accompanied you that long, dangerous, and fatiguing route to the Pacific Ocean and back, deserved a greater reward for her attention and services on that route that we had in our power to give her at the Mandans. So technically, this is him writing afterward.
Aww.
Because he keeps in touch with them. Because he loves pomp so much.
Yeah.
And he makes offers to them. He's like, look, he makes them two offers. He says, look, either I will pay for you all to come out here and work, or if you want to keep working for the government, I'll look after pomp, and I'll keep paying you to do this.
Aww.
So, let's see. As to your little son, my boy Pomp, you well know my fondness of him and my anxiety to take him and raise him as my own child. If you are disposed to accept either of my offers to you and will bring down your son, your famine, he wrote F-A-M-N, which we're guessing is like femme, woman.
Oh.
Your Janie had best come along with you to take care of the boy until I get him. Wishing you and your family great success, and with anxious expectations of seeing my little dancing boy Baptiste, I shall remain your friend, William Clark. Which, given what a shithead pain in the ass Charbonneau was, I'm like, this is him being nice because he really, really wants good things for Sacagawea and Pomp.
Yeah, I mean,
and he's like, we're good, right?
We're okay.
Friends.
I mean, I am definitely frustrated at the kind of cavalier, like, well, I'll just buy your kid from you, you know, attitude. But I also am trying to say that this comes from a good place, and he's just like, bring Janie, bring Pomp. Maybe I can gut Charbonneau and discreetly dispose of him in a Philadelphia alley, and I will take care of them both forever, ever. That's what I'm hoping it means.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of layers that go into that, right? Where on the one hand, this was an era when taking in people as wards and sending your kids off to get raised by somebody else was a much more common thing.
Okay.
But I think there's also a strong paternalistic, like, obviously, I can give him a much better life than you ever could give him thing. But then also, he's in the position of just having spent, you know, more than a year with these two and seen their extremely toxic dynamic.
Yeah.
And it's probably like, I don't like the idea of you being where I can't keep an eye on the situation.
Totally.
Like, come on over. Like, I have money. I have resources. Yeah. Like, both Lewis and Clark get very plush government appointments after the expedition, right? So he's pushing for this. Now we shall pause because they've separated, right? The parties of this story are no longer in the same place.
The fellowship has broken!
The fellowship has broken. And much like one of the many endings of Lord of the Rings, this is when we start to talk about how people die.
Yeah.
So, on Sunday, December 20th, 1812, right, so things wrap up for the expedition in 1806. Mm-hmm. And people go their separate ways, back to their other jobs, back to everything else. But of course, what does Charbonneau do? Like, he's a trapper, right? He's living his life. He's accumulating more involuntary wives, doing his thing. But in 1812, John C. Luttig, who's keeping a journal of his own, writes that this evening, the wife of Charbonneau, a snake woman, died of a putrid fever. She was a good and the best woman in the fort, aged about 25 years. She left a fine infant girl. So here's what we do know, is that there are translations of her name that called her Snake Woman. Mm-hmm. Based on the years, she would have been around 25.
Okay.
Right? She was Charbonneau's wife, according to the way they thought about this.
Yeah.
And I've read somewhere that they knew she was pregnant, but I'm like, how? I don't know if it like came up earlier in this journal or what. But again, he didn't say Sacagawea died.
Yes.
He said the wife of Charbonneau.
Yeah. And we know there's more than one.
There's more than three. There's quite a few. That's the first death, right? She's young. She gets putrid fever, which is like typhus.
Yeah.
It's a bacterium. It's a parasite that you get. And if you don't have antibiotics, you're done.
Yeah.
And her little daughter, or the little daughter, is Lisette. And then there's Jean-Baptiste, or Pom.
Mm-hmm.
And formally, they are both entrusted to Clark. Mm. He formally takes their guardianship at a St. Louis orphans court proceeding in 1813. So Jean-Baptiste, as soon as his mother died, he gets sent to Clark, and Clark enrolls him in boarding school. The best guess is that Lisette didn't survive infancy because we really don't have anything else about her.
Yeah.
But legally, at this point, when she dies, when this wife dies, Charbonneau is not at the fort. And the fact that Clark is able to legally adopt these kids says that they thought both parents were dead.
Yeah.
There was no CPS, right? Right. Like, there's no termination of parental rights. Either your parents are dead or they're not.
Yeah.
And they thought he was dead. He was not.
Mm-hmm.
But Clark ends up with little Pomp, you know, his little dancing Baptiste.
Yeah.
Yeah. And over a decade later, the last thing that we have him writing about her is when he's kind of doing a where are they now thing, and he's making a list of everybody who was on the expedition, and he says, Sacagawea dead.
Okay.
And they assume that he got it from that other journal, that the guy who was at the fort when she died passed this along.
Yeah.
But the fact that he didn't specifically call her out by name has led to this other interpretation.
Yes.
The mystery, the weirdness. We get there. So in the 20s, there's this revival of interest in the expedition, and it's kind of ebbed and flowed over the years. Like, at the time, it was not a big deal. They would have been shocked that they're, like, the best-known explorers of our time.
Yeah.
Right? Or of their time, or what, you know, if you're, like, name explorers, like, you're probably going to say Lewis and Clark if you're raised in the U.S. and educated in a certain system or whatever.
Right.
Like, they come to mind, but at the time, everybody's keeping journals. Everybody's exploring.
Yeah.
Like, they did a very ambitious exploration, but it wasn't supposed to be, like, the be-all, end-all. It wasn't mythological.
Right. Oh, and it's
one thing, though,
definitely become mythological in the American psyche.
It has.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. and tons of things named after them, and, like, you can picture it, and I'm thinking of, like, Night at the Museum, oh, where yeah. she's a character, and all this kind of stuff. So, one of the reasons why, after the turn from the 18th to the 19th century, she becomes more well-known is the push to get women the right to vote. Mm-hmm. And as a result, people become interested in mythologizing women of American history and saying, look, from the beginning, we've been a part of this.
Yeah.
And so they grab onto her as a symbol of this, and they hire Dr. Charles Eastman. Specifically, they, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, says, we want to know where her body is.
Yeah.
So Eastman goes around to many elders in various tribes, and he learns in 1924 about a Shoshone woman named Perivo, who said she was part of the Lewis and Clark expedition. So let's settle ourselves in time a bit here,
yeah. right?
So the expedition is 1804 to 1806.
Yeah.
He's looking at this in 1924.
Yeah.
If this woman was Sacagawea, she died on April 9th, 1884, at age about 95.
Okay.
That's the gap that we're looking at. And so she dies in 1884. So 40 years later, he's able to talk to elders who remember her.
Okay.
So according to the oral tradition, this woman had lived lots of different places. She spoke lots of languages. When her husband died, she took another husband. She had a couple sons. But when he died, she returned to the Wind River Indian Reservation and lived out her life with the Shoshone.
Okay.
Now, this one gives me a hard time.
Yeah.
You tell me. Well, you tell me what you're thinking about here right now.
I already have a hard time because if Sacagawea didn't die, how did Clark get parental rights of Jean-Baptiste?
I think what you have to assume is that she faked her death.
Which is...
Or she completely abandoned him.
Which is really sad. Mm-hmm. But also, I was not a sex trafficked child who was just trying to figure out how the fuck to live when I was, 17 years old when...
Yeah.
Or I guess 25 years old when she was supposed to have died. Mm-hmm. And I suppose she might think... I might think in that situation, the best shot my kid has is to get away from his abusive, awful father and yeah. out of an uncertain frontier or a tribal situation that is rapidly becoming unstable thanks to reservations and perhaps the protection of a well-meaning white man might be okay for him.
Yeah,
and I don't
remember
know.
Too, Baby Pomp has a tough road to navigate because he is yeah. half Shoshone yeah. and half French-Canadian.
Yeah.
So how well that's going to play in a country just coming off the War of 1812
yeah.
is really hard to say.
Yeah.
And certainly it's not as straightforward as if he was just like a baby that Clark could pass off as his own
totally.
Or something. He's going to live in a kind of difficult position socially because of the race issue.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not like she can just go back to her brother, which, you know, even if she could make all that travel by herself
yeah.
with a baby without the resources of the government, because,
yeah.
you know, she's gone all the way back to St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
She's not up with her people anymore. She's halfway across the country again.
Yeah.
So if she wanted to go back to her family, that's a gigantic undertaking.
Yeah.
Even with or without a baby. It doesn't track for me. It doesn't track for me that she would, well, I don't know. There are situations where people have been able to say, my baby is safer and better off in a situation that I can't join him in.
Right.
You know, sometimes people are able to make that sacrifice.
Yeah.
So I can't say whether or not she would have been able to, but I would say just logistically, doing that, especially when you're like, well, then where does Lizette come into the mix?
Yeah.
Like, so she's like postpartum limping,
yeah.
bleeding
yeah.
up the river.
Yeah.
This doesn't track.
Hmm.
This doesn't make sense. But at the same time, the part that I'm having a hard time with, I hate to discount oral tradition.
Yes.
the fact that this guy is talking to these people and they're like, I knew this person. She is buried right here.
Yeah.
Like, here's her gravestone. Like, they clearly know somebody.
Yeah.
Like, they're... It kind of reminds me, I mean, this is what we see with all our legendary West figures, right? Like, it happens with Bruce Cassidy, it happens with Billy the Kid, it happened with Calamity Jane.
Yeah.
You get doubles, you get offspring, you get life after death.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to make of it. Mm-hmm. I think it would be very unlikely for anyone to live to 95, but particularly in the 1800s, in the kind of resource-deprived situation that was being inflicted on the Shoshone people at the time. Like, that's a lot. It's not impossible, but it's rough.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't want to discount it. And I think one thing that is entirely possible is she was a woman who traveled with the Lewis and Clark expedition, but she wasn't the Sacagawea that we know.
Right? Yeah, right.
She was... Right. Another woman who traveled with them for a time and never made it in. Or she was, you know, sometimes they'll just be like, yeah, a woman came to do our laundry. Yeah,
right.
For all I'm we sure. know, she stuck with them for 6 months. But because she wasn't, you know, wearing blue beads and she didn't have a baby that they liked, they didn't really record her and think about her. They weren't doing an exhaustive thing. They're just giving us these odd little journals, insights into their minds.
Totally.
It's like reading the Harry Potter books, right? Like, you see what Harry sees.
Yeah, exactly.
We see what Lewis and Clark see.
Yeah.
And if they didn't see a woman, which they probably didn't, unless she really impressed them with how useful she was, then she could have easily been with them, but not been the person that we're thinking of.
Yeah.
And she's also important, right? She's not famous, but she was there.
Yeah. Yeah. She's got a cool fucking story, no matter who she was, Sacagawea or a different woman. She's got a really cool story. I want to know what that was.
I'm really happy that I brought her to the show. I think the fact that she has two graves 200 miles apart is wild. And I think all I know is that because of the resources that we have, we only glimpse her through a glass darkly.
Mm-hmm.
The part that I really like about the story where she died in 1884 is that she got to be a survivor.
Yeah.
And she got to live her own life without Charbonneau.
Yeah.
But I think realistically, she probably died young.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably didn't do much about it, you know?
Yeah.
I think her life was short, and she didn't get the credit that she deserved.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say, either way, it's quite, I mean, not melancholy. Yeah, if she died in 1884, then there's that, like, Kate Winslet steps off in New York and says her name is Rose Dawson and gets to live the rest of her life out from the shadow of the oppressors, right? Like you said, she gets to have this own life without Charbonneau. The reality is statistics, which is a lot of women, especially in and around childbirth, died super fucking young. I, much like in our Calamity Jane episode, would rather print the legend, and I like giving her at least the opportunity to have a fun story all on her own. So I mean, I would rather that she lived a beautiful, long, wonderful, fulfilling life and that her son grew up happy and healthy, whether it was with her or not, and that she, at the end of this long, wonderful life, you know, laid down and said, yep, did it my way, did it good, not a lot of regrets. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Here's one of the things that I think the she lived to 95 thing tries to reconcile, mm-hmm. which is she got screwed.
Dude, you know? Yeah.
She had a hard life. She did a very difficult job very well.
Yeah.
And then died young with no recognition. You know, nobody was like, oh, you're the Sacagawea.
Yeah.
Like, she just went back to being another purchased wife of a French Canadian trapper.
Yeah.
You know, like, the world didn't change for her. She's like, okay, that was nice. Like,
yeah.
I got to see a dead whale on a beach.
And somebody took my belt.
Yeah. To buy a robe. Jackass.
That I didn't get to wear, goddammit.
I've been relying very heavily here on Dale Walker's excellent book, Legends and Lies, Great Mysteries of the American West. And here's what he says. The Bird Woman died on two occasions, 72 years apart. And he describes, you know, the first event at Fort Manuel, that she dies. At first, Clark didn't think that Sacagawea was the Snake Woman who died. He thought that it must have been Otter Woman or somebody. But by the time he writes that Where Are They Now list, he says that she's dead. Then we have Charles Eastman, who goes out and gets this oral tradition that she leaves him. She gets sick of Charbonneau. She heads out. She spends many years wandering from tribe to tribe. She marries a Comanche man, has five children, moves back to the Shoshone Rez, does all this there, and reunites at Fort Washakie with Baptiste, with Pomp, and that she has another son, Basil, and they live together.
Oh.
So, to the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, I'm quoting directly from the book here, in 1925, Eastman wrote, "I report that Sacagawea, after 60 years of wandering from her own tribe, returned to her people at Fort Bridger and lived the remainder of her life with her sons in peace until she died April 9th, 1884 at Fort Washakie, Wyoming. That is her final resting place." Here's the other part that makes the later death really appealing, because then we would know where she is.
Yeah.
Because if she died in 1812 or so in Fort Manuel, we don't know where her body went. She was buried in an unmarked grave.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Shit, dude. She was fucking cool as hell. No matter when she died, she fucking lived like a boss.
Exactly. She lived a very cool life, and so did 100 other people who went on explorations and had adventures and knew so much about that land that we purchased back then. And their stories are interesting, too. I think the significance of her having two deaths is exactly what I've been struggling with through the whole story, which is we know so little about her, and the only glimpses we get are through the voices of others.
Yeah.
And so it's, practically speaking, more realistic to think that she died young at the fort. It would be nice to think that she lived a long time and got to be back with her people.
Yeah.
But I think in some ways it lets us fantasize that someone can come back from that kind of brutal colonization and everything is okay.
Yeah.
And so I think my takeaway from having researched this and thought about it is that I will continue to engage with her image and her legacy in a way that I hope honors the fact that she was making choices within a very constrained situation and seems to have been a very cool person that we are fated to know very little about.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that there were moments on the trail that were good for her. I hope when she got to see the whale, or when she was putting together those weasel tails,
saw her brother Clark, again,
or you know, playing with the baby, or you know, got praised for saving things in the boat. I hope that there were moments of light, whether it was over a 25-year lifespan or a 95-year. That's what I can hope for her. Well, on a lighter note, if people want to see me making fun of how William Clark spells things, then you should be getting on the social media with us. I plan to continue doing it because it's fun to read his stuff and it's fun to figure out what the hell he's talking about. You know, at 3 o'clock, the Murky fell to 22 degrees below freezing. Oh, no, what, the Murky.
What was fosted over?
Oh, yeah, the Mississippi was froze across.
Froze across.
Yeah, and then you made a picture of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes and put it froze across flakes, and it made me so happy.
Yes, did you see my Taylor Swift meme? response.
Yes.
Go see how smart
poker
I is.
Poker hicks a nut to shake. We don't know what that means.
No.
Poker hake the nut to shake.
Poker hake. Poker
hake. And here's the thing I will give Clark credit for, is that sometimes he was trying to write down Indian words for stuff, but he never starts with, the Indian word for this is whatever.
Yeah.
He just will be like, poker's hake the nut to shake. And you're like, my friend. That's not how writing works.
James Bond's having a stronk.
Yeah. Call the Bondulance.
Call the Bondulance. Bond names the game.
Oh, Lord. So, yeah, get on Facebook, get on Twitter, get at us on Instagram, come to OuijaBroads.com. I am working on transcripts. I've kind of fallen behind on them just because it's hard to find the time, yep. But I am still working on those. You should make sure that you're subscribed to us in the podcatcher of your choice, mm-hmm. that you've rated and reviewed. Since my last time asking people to rate us, I have rated several shows, including, God, I don't even remember. Here's one I do remember, is I five-starred What If World, and I was tagging them because I was tagging everybody I had given good ratings to. And that's one of the shows I listened to with Lydia. And the host, who I think of as Mr. Eric, even though he's probably younger than me, was like, I'll have to check out your show. And I'm like, Mr. Eric can't hear me do a swear.
No, Mr. Eric.
That can't be. Not you, Mr. Eric.
Oh, my goodness.
You inhabit a magical world and give voices to, I don't know, lesbian fairies and stuff. Like, my point is that if you got shows that you like, including us, it's very quick to give us a rating on iTunes or whatever you're listening on, and it does us a lot of good, and we would appreciate that a lot.
Means a lot.
I want to give thanks to our new patrons, our old patrons, our ongoing patrons, and if you would like to be among them, you can come to patreon.com/OuijaBroads. Get full-length, unedited episodes, sometimes very unedited episodes. Get bonus audio, early release stuff. We've experimented over the time that we've had it with what to put out, and I've decided I think the best thing is just more audio.
Yeah.
You know, more of us talking about stuff, whether it means an episode that includes all the digressions,
yeah.
or even just taping half an hour about tattoos like we did today. And you know why that is because we and you are going to live weird.
We and you are going to die weird.
And let's all together stay weird. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening.